It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Saturday, December 31st, 2022. I'm Jared Halpern. Republicans are prepared to take back the House, but big questions remain about the agenda and who will hold the Speaker's gavel.
And I think it's going to be incumbent upon all of us to work together to, pass an agenda.
I'm Ryan Schmelz. In early 2022, the world was shocked as Russia invaded the neighboring country, Ukraine, causing widespread condemnation from the United States and other United Nations members. And the former ambassador to Ukraine was watching the UN General Assembly very closely.
The example of a big nation on their borders invading them for no reason, unjustified, unprovoked. No nation wants that to be the standard of behavior in the world.
This is the Fox News Rundown from Washington.
Kudlow on Fox Business is now on the go for podcast fans. Get key interviews with the biggest business newsmakers of the day. The Kudlow podcast will be available on the go after the show every weekday at foxbusinesspodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
Who will be elected Speaker of the House next week? Republican leader Kevin McCarthy certainly will start in the poll position, but by all accounts, he is short of the 218 votes from his party needed to claim the gavel. His path to the speakership was complicated after Republicans underperformed in this year's midterm elections. Predictions of a red wave fizzled. Democrats actually picked up a seat in the Senate. And the House will be very narrowly controlled, 222 to 213. In other words, McCarthy cannot lose more than 4 Republican votes, a total exceeded by those so far describing themselves as hard nose. That opposition comes from McCarthy's right flank, the conservative House Freedom Caucus looking to flex influence and win concessions on how the House operates in committee positions. But the majority makers, those Republicans who flipped seats held by Democrats and won 2 years ago by President Biden, also have influence, generally more moderate voices, mindful of the swing districts they represent. One of those majority-making Republicans is Mike Lawler, who upset Democrat Sean Patrick Maloney, a member of Democratic leadership in a New York City suburban district. I spoke with Lawler days after the November election for his take on the speaker's race and the Republican agenda he wants to pursue.
Yeah, I mean, in New York especially, you know, Democrats control everything in Washington, Albany, and New York City for the first time in our nation's history. And I think voters here wanted to restore balance and common sense. They were tired of one-party rule and the woke progressive ideology that, frankly, is destroying our economy and making our communities less safe. And you know, on those two main issues of inflation and the cost of living and crime, Democrats own it, and their policies have contributed to the deteriorating economy and the rising crime. And so I think that was, you know, the biggest factor in why we picked up 4 seats here in New York and are going to be sending 11 Republicans down to Congress come January, which is the highest in years, coupled with redistricting, which certainly played a big role here in giving us a fair map. After Democrats tried to gerrymander it.
Let's talk a little bit about that district. I think as we think about it, sort of outside of New York, sort of viewed as sort of these northern New York suburbs, you win this race, at least by the latest count I saw, by about a percentage point. So several thousand votes. This is a pretty swingy district. Do you think about that? Is, you know, you sort of figure out how you want to govern and what kind of congressman you want to be?
Yeah, listen, this district is the immediate suburbs of New York City, Rockland, Westchester, Putnam and Dutchess counties. It's a D+3 on the Cook PBI rating. There's 70,000 more Democrats than Republicans. My current assembly district that I represent has 22,000 more Democrats than Republicans. It's a 2-to-1 Democratic district. So you know, I've had to, in both elections, reach out across the aisle and earn the support of Democrats and independents and Republicans alike on the issues that matter. And I think for me, in doing that again, you know, as a member of Congress, I'm going to do what I always do, which is talk to everybody, work to get things done on behalf of my district, make sure that we are tackling the issues that matter to folks here, whether we're talking about the cost of living or crime or immigration or education. There's a lot of important issues and people want to see results. They're tired of gridlock. They're tired of partisan bickering. And I think, you know, as a member of Congress, that's going to be my focus.
The Republican, and it looks like a Republican majority, though probably a smaller one than we had expected, is going to have to find areas of common ground to at least pass legislation, right, to get it through the Senate, to get it signed by President Biden. What are those areas, in your view, that you kind of want to focus on and tackle on as you get into Washington now in the next couple of months?
No question. And, you know, I think it's also going to be incumbent upon the White House and the Senate, depending on how that breaks down, to work with the House as well. It's got to be a give and a take here. But I think my focus will be to tackle inflation, reduce the out of control, reckless spending down in Washington, increase domestic production of energy, tackle our poor southern border. I mean, we need to secure the border. You cannot continue to have tens of thousands of migrants coming into the country illegally, fentanyl pouring across our southern border. It doesn't work. Fortunately, under the Biden administration and one party rule in Washington, it's been a lot of groupthink rather than trying to come up with policies that work.
One of the ways that immigration has been handled previously, and it's not gone anywhere, but at least the proposals have always been a mix of enhanced, increased border security with some reforms to, say, the DACA program, trying to find these pathways to legal status or citizenship for those who are already here. What is your approach to immigration to border security?
So I think there's three prongs here, right? Number one, you have to secure the border. I mean, it's been talked about, and nothing has really gotten done. I mean, under the Trump administration, there was certainly progress, but the Biden administration has pretty much reversed course and allowed entry of over 3 million illegal immigrants in less than 2 years. So you have to secure the border. Number two, you have to deal with the legal immigration system. My wife is an immigrant from Eastern Europe. She came here over a decade ago. She earned her citizenship 2 years ago. So I understand that process. We've been through it. But it needs a lot of work. It needs to be fixed. People who want to come here legally, who want to contribute to our economy and our culture and our communities, we should be welcoming them, and we should be working to have a system that is workable towards coming here. The third thing is certainly, obviously, you have over 20 million people who are here illegally, and we have to deal with that. You're not rounding up 20 million people and kicking them out. Obviously, you have the DACA program, which we have to deal with, and you have to create a system here that will address the challenges, but also be fair in creating a opportunity for legalization. Whether that includes citizenship down the road certainly is up for discussion. But I think you have to come up with a system that works here to address the 20 million people plus who are here illegally.
There have been members of your party, members in Congress who are Republicans, who have suggested that perhaps it's time to end the U.S. financial support for Ukraine. Where are you on that question?
Well, as I said, my wife is an immigrant from Eastern Europe. She comes from Moldova. Her family lives on the Ukraine border, about 30 miles from it, as the crow flies. I've been to Moldova many times, and including near Transnistria, which is a Russian occupied area. Vladimir Putin is a vile thug and a dictator, and he cannot be allowed to succeed in his efforts to topple Ukraine. And I think if he is successful, many of those former Soviet satellite states are next on his drawing board. And I think we need to be cognizant of that. I think we need to be serious about finding resolution here and supporting Ukraine. In addition, you know, when Ukraine gave up its nuclear power, they had entered into a agreement with us, and we promised to provide support and protect them, you know, and I think we need to fulfill our commitments there. So, you know, I know many of my future colleagues are concerned about the cost and oversight. And I think those are certainly fair questions to be raised. And I think the Biden administration needs to provide a long-term plan here. But I think it is incumbent upon us, and it's in our national security interests, to support Ukraine in this war against Russia.
One of the first votes that a new member of Congress takes is for Speaker of the House. Do you have somebody in mind who you're planning on voting for that position?
Yeah, I will be supporting Kevin McCarthy. He was extremely supportive in my race here. Working with us and tirelessly advocating for us. And, you know, I'm a big believer in sticking with the one who brought you to the dance. So I will be supporting Kevin McCarthy.
How do you sort of envision these conversations as you listen? The Republican Party is a big tent. It is, you know, just like the Democrats in the House have had their sort of internal disputes. We seem to sort of be seeing this play out a little bit now, at least in the news and through the media. What sort of Republican conference are you planning on kind of walking into here?
Look, I obviously, based on the results, it's looking like it's going to be a relatively narrow majority. And I think it's going to be incumbent upon all of us to work together to, you know, pass an agenda that the conference supports. And I think, you know, in any conference, you're going to have geographic differences. Mm-hmm. You're going to have some political differences. But that's nothing new in politics, and you work through it and you come up with the best policy agenda that you can that has the support of the conference. And that's what we'll work towards.
Have you given much thought to sort of the committees you'd be interested in serving in, maybe some of the oversight hearings you're interested in?
I'm interested in, you know, financial services, appropriations, foreign affairs, transportation, infrastructure. Those are certainly committees that I'm looking at. Mm-hmm. But definitely, you know, my objective, regardless of committee assignment, is to tackle the issues that matter to my constituents and the people who elected me.
I don't want to get too far ahead of the calendar, but obviously it's been talked about here over the last couple of weeks. Have you given much thought to who the Republicans nominate in 2024?
No, and obviously, you know, that will play itself out over the coming weeks and months. I mean, you know, the former president will decide what he's going to do. But I think, you know, we have a lot of people in the party over the last few years, rising stars, people who have, you know, won pretty impressively, like Governor DeSantis on Tuesday night. So we'll see how this plays out. And ultimately, the voters within a Republican primary will decide who's the best person to lead.
I'll finish with this. Have you had the opportunity to talk to some of your colleagues or, I guess, incoming colleagues? And I mean, I'm always curious when people join Congress, are there like members that you are sort of modeling yourself after? Are there those that you've kind of looked to as sort of an example of how you kind of want to go about the job?
So I've spoken to many of my, you know, soon to be colleagues, had a lot of good conversations. I'm really looking forward to getting to work with them to tackle these challenges. As I've said in the past, one of the people that I respect and admire and is a good friend is Pete King, the former congressman from Long Island. I think Pete always did a great job representing New York and standing up for his district. And, you know, advocating for Republican policies and principles, and, you know, and at times when he disagreed, you know, speaking out. And I think it's important to first and foremost represent your district and the people who elect you as you support the party and the conference.
Did it feel like an upset when you won?
You know, to be honest, no,
okay.
Because when I got into the race, I didn't run to lose. And I've done this before. I've defeated a long-term Democrat incumbent in a 2-1 Democratic district. I know how to do it. And so, you know, I knew what I was getting into when I decided to run. I understood the map and the coalition that we needed to put together. And ultimately, the results didn't surprise me in the least.
In 2023, a new Congress will take over, and how much and how long the United States will continue to send aid to Ukraine as the nation continues to battle Russia will likely be discussed and possibly debated. The majority of Congress on a bipartisan level and President Joe Biden have stood in support of Ukraine, as has much of the United Nations. Back in September, world leaders descended on New York City for the 77th session of the United Nations General Assembly. President Biden strongly condemned Russia's invasion, but it wasn't the only takeaway.
President Biden at the UN gave a spirited condemnation of the Russian actions, which I think reflects the view of most Americans.
William Taylor served as ambassador to Ukraine under three different presidents and joined us to not just talk about the war, but also its impact on China's aggression towards Taiwan.
The Russian invasion of Ukraine and its atrocities and its war crimes is repugnant to the United States. It's repugnant to the UN. The UN recognizes Ukraine as a sovereign state, along with all the other members of the UN. And so it's right that the United States and other nations, all of whom lined up to condemn the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So I think the UN served a function.
But did it do enough to maybe bring in some of the countries that have abstained in the matter? I believe South Africa has abstained when it comes to condemning Russia, and the president has tried to meet with their president to try to bring him on board. Do you think that did enough to maybe bring some of those hesitant countries over?
It's a good question, Ryan. It's a good question, because you're right. Even though well over 100 countries, every time the UN General Assembly votes, well over 100 vote to condemn Russia, and the Russians are able to cobble together five, maybe seven votes in their favor. So it's like 5-7 against 100 or 101 or 140. So the overwhelming votes in the UN do reflect that there are some abstentions, and that's what you're asking about. And it's so interesting that that the Chinese have not supported Russia in these votes. They've abstained. The Indians have not supported the Russians in these votes. They've abstained. And you're right, there is the question about the abstentions and where those nations are with regard to an invasion. I have to believe that no nation wants to have the precedent, the example of a big nation on their borders invading them for no reason, unjustified, unprovoked. No nation wants that to be the standard of behavior in the world. So even though there is overwhelming opposition to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and even though they have no support, virtually no support among nations of the world, the abstentions, the nations who are abstaining need to think carefully about what kind of a world they want to live in. And I think in answer to your question, Ryan, I think the discussion is bringing that home to many nations. We'll see. We'll see how this plays out.
And you just mentioned China there. How did you feel the president's messaging on Taiwan has been over the last week or so? Obviously, we had some major developments with that, but how do you think it was when it comes to Taiwan and China?
So I think the Chinese are in a difficult position. They signed up to support President Putin before he invaded. We remember that President Putin visited Beijing just before the invasion, just at the beginning of the Beijing Olympics. And President Putin and President Xi signed a long document that promised no limits to their cooperation. And yet, a couple of weeks later, probably unbeknownst to the Chinese, certainly in the scope, the Russians invaded their neighbor. The Chinese have indicated, with the abstentions that I just mentioned, and other actions, that they're not happy. They're not pleased. They've indicated that very directly, very publicly to the Russians, that they have concerns. They have questions about this. The Chinese say that they support sovereignty of nations and territorial integrity of nations. We can debate whether their actions demonstrate those principles, but nonetheless, when they're an ally, but the Russians, when they are associated with the Chinese, do not help the Chinese when they try to make the case for some stable form of international relations. So we have to push the Chinese to continue to abstain. We have to push the Chinese to continue to not send military equipment. They've not been willing to send military equipment to the Russians. They've not been willing to help the Russians evade the sanctions. The Chinese know that the sanctions that we've put on the Russians could be applied to them if the Chinese try to help the Russians get around those sanctions. So we have to have a strong message for the Chinese on this issue.
And do you think the negative attention in the unified condemnation of Russia's invasion of Ukraine is having an impact on how China might react to the situation in Taiwan?
I do. I think you're exactly right. I think the Chinese are watching what happens in Ukraine very carefully. I imagine that the Chinese are surprised at a couple of things. One, they're probably surprised that the West has been so unified, not just on the military side, but also on the economic sanctions side, that this could happen to them, the Chinese, if they were to invade Taiwan. So that's probably a surprise. They're also probably surprised at how badly the Russian military has done. And it makes them, I imagine, a little worried about their own capabilities. If the Russian military, which was supposed to have been so strong, is having such a hard time, indeed, is being beaten by the Ukrainian military, then the Chinese have to worry about their own military capabilities as well. Invading Taiwan, as we know, is much harder than the Russian invasion of Ukraine. There's 100 miles of water between the Chinese mainland and Taiwan. That's a hard military operation. And the Chinese are seeing how the Russians are being thwarted by the Ukrainian military in what should be an easier military operation. So all to say, right, I think there are lessons that the Chinese are learning, not happy lessons, that the Chinese are learning from the Russian bungling invasion of Ukraine.
And now getting back to Ukraine, do you believe the president went far enough, not just to address Russia's aggression here, but also the potential, you know, threat of using nuclear weaponry here, which was kind of alluded to this week, as well as the fact that we've seen Russia now looking like they're going to start calling up reserves and reservists and potentially more and more soldiers into this effort.
You make a good point about the reserves. The Russians have a very big problem on manpower. They are short of soldiers. They've lost an incredible number of soldiers, and they've not been able to replace them. We've seen stories how the Russians are trying to get prisoners of war in jails, prisoners that are held in Russian jails to fight for them, and they've had no success. We've seen how the Russians have been trying to get the Libyans and the Syrians and the North Koreans and the Belarusians. They have a big soldier problem. So they're trying now to get more Russians by expanding the draft. The draft so far has been a failure because Russian men don't want to volunteer. And so now more Russian men are not going to want to volunteer when they expand the draft. So that is a problem for the Russians. You also mentioned the nuclear threat. President Putin and many of his ministers have made this threat before. They have said that, don't forget, we have nuclear weapons, as if we needed to be reminded. We have to take that threat seriously, of course. The United States has no, and our security forces, our military forces, we have no higher mission, no higher attempt to watch the Russian military and its nuclear capabilities. And so far, those careful observations, those careful alerts, being very open and very careful about what we're watching the Russians do, have indicated no increase in the Russian status of their nuclear forces. But that could change. And President Putin's irresponsible threats, at least implicit threats, to use nuclear weapons is not only irresponsible, but is a problem for him. The Chinese, we talked about this before, the Chinese, the Indians, the South Africans that you mentioned, these nations are undoubtedly counseling President Putin not to use nuclear weapons. There is no reason for him to use nuclear weapons against a nuclear unarmed Ukraine. This would be a horrible precedent, a horrible message, and would further isolate him. And I'm sure he's hearing from all of these people who are abstaining, maybe even from the nations that are supporting him. He's hearing this: do not use nuclear weapons. And the United States is giving the same message: do not use these, because there will be a response. If Mr. Putin makes a bad decision, a horrible decision, to use nuclear weapons in Ukraine, there will be a response. There's no doubt about that.
And so overall, do you think this was a successful week in terms of messaging, agreements, and progress with Ukraine overall?
So I was very impressed, Ryan, with the message that President Zelensky gave. First of all, he won another vote in the General Assembly, 101 to 7, to allow him to give that speech from Kyiv rather than coming to New York. And so there was overwhelming support for that speech. And when he gave it, the General Assembly Hall was rapt, was focused, was listening. He gave a well-thought-out speech. He made the case against the Russian invasion, how Russia must be punished, how Russia must pay for the damage it's done to all the Ukrainian people, to all of the Ukrainian infrastructure, to all the Ukrainian families who have lost soldiers, lost loved ones. President Zelensky made this case in a passionate, focused, I think very effective way. At the end of that speech, at the end of President Zelensky's speech, he received a standing ovation, which is another indication that the United Nations, as flawed as it is, let's be clear, the United Nations was founded in order to prevent this kind of war, and it failed. It failed to prevent this kind of war. Nonetheless, President Zelensky encouraged the members of the United Nations to stand up to Russia, punish them, make the Russians pay. President Zelensky made the point about Ukrainian determination to win. And we're supporting his determination to win. We're supporting him with weapons and finances and moral support. And I believe, in answer to your question, Ryan, I believe that President Zelensky made the case and won over more support from the United Nations and the people of the world to support Ukraine and to oppose the Russian invasion.
And kind of piggybacking off that, you know, what still needs to be done here, or what do you think the UN could be doing better to support Ukraine?
President Zelensky was very clear about that. He needs weapons. He needs heavy weapons. He needs longer range weapons. He needs higher altitude anti-air defense, anti-air weapons. He needs the ability to protect his country, and he needs the ability to push the Russians out of his land. There are Russian soldiers in Ukraine now, on Ukrainian territory, on sovereign Ukrainian land, and President Zelensky made the case that he needs support. He needs financial support, absolutely. He needs diplomatic support, absolutely. He needs weapons support, and he made that very clear, that with that kind of support continuing, I mean, he's getting very good support so far, he needs more. And if he gets that support, he will do what the international community wants done, which is to stop this invasion, is to push the Russians out of Ukraine. And President Zelensky was very clear about how to do that, and that's to support Ukraine.
Now, going off of that, when you talk about funding for Ukraine or providing weapons for Ukraine, you know, every time we hear about more aid for Ukraine come through, from the United States, it kind of spills over into American politics a little bit. You can see military leaders at press conferences or different members of Congress have to kind of justify to the American people sending significant amount of money or resources over to Ukraine when, in fact, you know, we've got a lot of issues in our country that we have to deal with that money could be used for. You know, how long is this sustainable for the UN and all its different members to keep sending supplies over to Ukraine before anything happens?
The right question. And what we see so far, and you're right to say that it's not guaranteed to continue, but so far, bipartisan support for the assistance to Ukraine, bipartisan support for opposition to Russia, bipartisan support for expansion of NATO to include Finland and Sweden, bipartisan support for sanctions on Russia. So this broad bipartisan support, yes, there are people who have questions, as they should. You're exactly right. We're providing a lot of weapons, equipment, ammunition, finances, economic support to the Ukrainians. And it's because we see how important this fight is. We see how important it is to stop the Russian invasion. We see how important it is for Ukraine to win. And that vision of Ukraine winning is shared, as we've seen in all of these votes so far, by a bipartisan group of senators and congressmen that are committed to Ukraine's success. And that's a broad group. That is a broad group. There are people that want to be sure that this money is accounted for. Absolutely right. Absolutely right. They're right to ask for accountability. I will tell you, the Ukrainians are demanding accountability as well of their own people and of their own supply chain. The Ukrainians have more at stake than anyone to be sure that those weapons are getting exactly to the right place on the front line so as to defend their country against this Russian invasion. So the Ukrainians have in place, and the U.S. government and the embassy in Kyiv has in place, ways to be sure, to account for, to be very carefully alert to any problems on the distribution. And so far, they've been successful. So far, those weapons are getting to the right place. But you're right about the interest in accountability. And you're right about the interest in making sure that all these funds are well used. And you're right, there are domestic needs. There's no doubt about it. And so we have to do both. We have to do both. We have to recognize that our security is wrapped up in Ukrainian success. Our security, our national security, the United States national security is wrapped up in that. If Ukraine does not win, if the Russians are able to take over Ukraine, we are in jeopardy. We are in jeopardy. Our allies are then on the direct front line, our NATO allies. So we have a lot at stake here. Yes, we have domestic needs and we should be dealing with those. Absolutely. And that does not mean we can't do both. We must do both. We must protect our security and we must take care of American people. It's part of the same thing.
All right. Ambassador Taylor, is there anything missing that you would like to add?
So, Ryan, the only other thing I would say is just to emphasize how brave the Ukrainians have been. I mean, many people thought around the world that the Ukrainians would not be able to stand up to the Russians. And we've all been amazed, inspired, awestruck in some real sense at how the Ukrainians have pulled together their military, civilians, their government, their police. They have stood up to the Russians in a way that no one thought they could. They're on the front lines, Ryan. They are on the Ukrainians on the front lines for us. They're fighting for values that we hold. They're fighting for their own land, but they're also defending Europe against Russian aggression. So we have a lot at stake there. It's our security. It is our values that we are defending, and the Ukrainians are on the front line.
Ambassador Taylor, thank you so much for joining us.
Ryan, thanks for having me very much.
Stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com.
pull up a chair and join me, Rachel Campos Duffy.
And me, former U.S. Congressman Sean Duffy, as we share our perspective on the discussions happening at kitchen tables across America.
Download From the Kitchen Table, The Duffys, at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download podcasts.